the direction of the sounds that they heard. The researchers played either one sound or two sounds, with each sound at a different frequency and coming from different locations. When the researchers played two sounds together, the monkeys looked first in the direction of one sound and then in the direction of the other sound, indicating that the monkeys recognized the existence of two discrete sounds. To find out how the monkey's brain encoded both sounds simultaneously, the team used electrodes in the inferior colliculus, a key point in the brain's auditory pathway, to measure the small spikes in the local electric field caused by neurons firing. The researchers investigated the response of single neurons to both individual sounds and to combined sounds. The standard practice in the field is to count how many spikes occur over a period of time and compute the average of a number of trials. But this method obscures any fluctuation in activity that might indicate the neurons are switching back and forth between different stimuli. Let me drop. They found that a single neuron could respond to one sound with one firing rate and a second sound with a different firing rate. When both sounds were played simultaneously, it appeared to fluctuate between the two firing rates. Sometimes the fluctuations were fast enough that the neuron switched within a half second of the presentation of the sound, and in other cases, the switching was even slower. The team repeated the statistical analysis on data from experiments conducted from another researcher. In these experiments, researchers investigated the firing rates of single neurons in a visual area of the cortex in response to images of one face or two faces. The analysis revealed the same switching behavior when two faces were present. These findings provide clues to other circumstances where the brain has to do more than one thing at a time with a limited set of neurons. For example, our working memory, the number of things we can hold in our mind at one time, is constrained to about 5 or 7 items. Let me drop. While these experiments do not directly test working memory, the researchers think further studies may help explain these restrictions. Our working memory system is quite limited, and no one really knows why, researchers said. Perhaps that limit arises from some kind of cycling behavior where you are coding one thing at a time and across a period of time. The number of things you can represent depends on how long you need to represent each one and how rapidly you can switch. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Okay, very good, gentlemen. It's time for the space report. I just want to remind everyone once again that I will post all the links to all these articles on roy.ac2gs.com. And if anyone feels the need to comment on anything, these things, or has a subject they would like me to bring up, or wants to dispute anything, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Thank you very much, and Paul, it's all yours.
Okay, and one other comment about the Space Force topic. Roy, the guy that they want to put in charge of that is a ham radio operator. I looked this up a couple of weeks ago when they talking about this. I wanted to find out, well, who would get this job, and it looks like Michael Griffin. He used to be head of NASA some years ago, and it's called NR3A. He's still a ham. So it's interesting. If they ever do go through this, he's like at the top of the list for the guy to be picked. Back to you, Roy.
D2OR.
One second, David. Isn't he still working at NASA, though? I thought he still had some kind of a job description at NASA.
Involved, but whether he's actually with NASA or not, I don't know. He's got some other kind. I think it's something to do with the defense, or there's always a link between the defense and NASA. So he might be some kind of a job doing that. But yeah, he's still active.
Okay, yeah, because I noticed on a ham's website they were very proud to announce that we have an amateur radio operator at NASA. David, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, Roy, I remembered what I wanted to say. I saw an exhibit at NYU for neuroscience and neuroscience. And there was a picture of this guy on the wall, and he was wearing a long lab coat. He had one year of art training and 10 years of medical training, and he was hired by his clients to make pictures of slices of what the brain looks like and all the activity inside, according to neuroscience. But if he did it according to molecular science, it would look completely different.
Well, I'm not quite sure what that really means, because you could do things based on your imagination. You could do things based on research. You can do things based on different imaging technology. And as time goes on, we have more and more imaging technology. We have functional NMRs that allow you to see the oxygen uptake and metabolism of a given portion of your brain to figure out what parts of your brain light up when you think or you do something. So there's a lot to be said for all kinds of interpretations. I wouldn't close the book on it quite yet. I think we have many, many years of research to go on. And just as a sweetener for next week, I'm going to tell you a story about a 10-year-old kid that had 1/6 of his brain removed and what happened to him. So I think we should turn it over to poor Paul, because I'm sure he wants to do the space report.
Quick question, KC1SAM.
Okay, question away.
I think you're using a different radio. Are you using the same microphone on both radios?
In a word, no.
Please be quick, that's it.
Okay, very good. How you doing, Sam? And I'm starting to think there's some kind of little transmitter up on the roof of your house, and every once in a while it's going off, and it's mixing in with the signal as you're going out. I don't know what this is all about, but I guess you're gonna have to move, Roy.
I thought this was a tolerable signal. It also has problems.
It's much more tolerable than the other one. But, yeah, you'll hear it on the recording. It still clips in and out, but nowhere near like the other one. So there's a difference. Now I can't hear your input, so I can't judge. But, sooner or later we're going to get to the bottom of it.
Okay, maybe I have a UFO on my roof.
Was that Eric? Everything started with neuroscience, and it's based on that. Everything to follow is based on the first study of neuroscience. Anyway, have a good night.
Okay, I hope I didn't double with him in the beginning. This is WS1 for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And starting off, I was talking about Ham before, possibly being in charge of the Space Force, but forget about the Space Force. There's three other Hams out of the next 9 astronauts that have been picked to fly on our commercial flights, which will be starting sometime next year, probably early next year. They'll be flying on the Dragon crew vehicle, and they'll be flying on the Starliner by Boeing, and the Crew Dragon by SpaceX. There's Robert Benkin. He's KE5GGX. And he'll be doing the very first Dragon crew flight. My guess that will be the first one that we see actually going up. And he's got Douglas Hurley with him, but the other fellows are studying. Actually, some of them right now are studying for their test. They're working on working with the contractors to work on the design and completion of the manned space vehicles, but at the same time, they're also training to get their technician license. But like I said, Robert Benkin, KU5GGX, of course, he already has it. He's been up in space before on the ISS. He's worked the Ares program, the amateur radio on the International Space Station. He's done that before. And you've got Michael Hopkins, KF5LJG, and he'll be going up on probably the second Dragon mission. That would be considered a regular crew mission after the first test. And he'll be going up with Victor Grover. And last but not least, Sony Williams, KD5PLB. She's had her ham license for many, many years. And she's been up to the space station a couple of times. She's famous for giving a tour on the space station. You always talk about YouTube. If you ever look up Sony Williams, her first name is they spell it S-U-N-I-T-A, but they call it Sony Williams. KD5PLB is going to be, she's the one that gives a tour of the International Space Station when she's up there. It's a very, very good job. You can show it to kids and everything. Kids really like it. But she'll be flying on the first Starliner regular mission. So that's always good to hear, and that means some of these people will be staying up for sometimes 6 months at a time, and some of them will eventually be working on the Ares system out of the Columbia module. The Russians have their people going up, and they work out of the functioning block car, they call it the functioning FSG, functioning cargo block module. So they have their setup. They usually operate a different ham radio than what we use in the Columbia. But if one is down for any reason, which has happened in the past, they can swap over and use the other ham radio. So there's actually two stations on board. So this week I want to talk about some of the newer companies that we don't usually talk about that have either launched rockets or planning to launch rockets for, with small payloads, 300, 400, 500,000 pound payloads into orbit. And there's a couple of them. For instance, there's one private company called Exo Aerospace. They're going to be launching a rocket at the end of this month, probably within a couple of days, from a place called Spaceport America, which is located in New Mexico. The taxpayers of New Mexico built this big spaceport, and they've had a couple of small launches there. Nothing orbital yet, but right now they have plenty of land, plenty of space. Eventually, it will be used by Virgin Galactic to launch their Spaceship One vehicle. Spaceship Two vehicle. But this other company, Exos, is going to launch in a couple of days a rocket called Sarge, a suborbital autonomous rocket with guidance. And it's going to be suborbital, but very soon will be orbital. So these people are pouring money into rocketry. Their ultimate goal is to launch payloads for colleges, for private business, even for NASA. Like, for instance, the Zexos company comes out of another company that was also building rockets, Armadillo. They kind of went under, put everything on hold, but yet they come up under another name called Exos. Some of the same people that were involved with Armadillo are now with this company. Another suborbital launch just happened Monday from Wallops Island, Virginia. That's where students get together and put together multiple payloads on one rocket. And the ones I'm talking about, goes under the name Rock On, you know, for rockets. They call it Rock On, and they have a half a dozen of these small payloads from different colleges, and they spend sometimes months and definitely all summer putting together rockets and putting it on this, they call them sounding rockets, which, again, are suborbital. They'll go, you know, 100 miles into space and come back maybe 30, 40, 50 miles out of the sea, and then they'll recover them and bring their payloads, their spacecraft, back to wherever they were developed so that the students could look at it. The one payload in this particular rocket came out of College of Colorado, another one called Capital Technology University, Temple University had another one, and another one out of Colorado, Boulder, as well as Maryland and Puerto Rico and Virginia Tech, and even West Virginia, all on one rocket. So they all have their projects that they put together, and it all goes on the name Rock On. If you ever bring up Rock On, rocket launches, even Wikipedia has plenty of information about what they do. And one of our hams that are involved here that does one of our websites, Mike in Connecticut, has been involved with the Rock On group for, I think, many years. And I forgot his call. I know Dick will remember it. I should remember it too. I've emailed him quite a few times. Another private company is coming out of Japan, so it's not only the United States, and it's called Interstellar Technologies. They had a failure at the end of June launching the MOMO2 rocket. It was supposed to be a rocket that was going to launch a small payload to a low orbit. And it didn't work out, but they're going to try again, and they think by the end of the year they'll succeed. Another company, a private company out of China, called OneSpace. They're launching their OS-1 or OneSpace rocket, again, for private companies, for private money. And they launched in April, and then now they're going to do an orbital flight probably by the end of this year. Another company called Firefly, that's an American company. Firefly is going to launch the Alpha rocket. They've already launched two suborbital flights, one from a launch complex in Georgia, Camden, Georgia. That was successful. And another one, I think they launched from, that was from New Mexico as well, I'd have to check. Another company called Vector. Vector is launching, they have two rockets they're developing, one for suborbital and one for orbital. And they've launched a couple of rockets as well. I believe Vector is the one that launched from Camden, Georgia. But to give you an idea, there's at least a half a dozen companies, private companies, that I've come up with that we don't usually talk about that are heavily involved in putting a lot of money into rocket development. You know, there is a goal of putting some 10,000 satellites in space not too far into the future. SpaceX is involved with that, and OneWeb. These companies are going to create an internet in space internet. You need tens of thousands of satellites, it looks like, so they'll be probably looking for that money. as well as from other private companies that that want to launch payloads. Planet Lab is another one. They have all kinds of cameras even presently right now looking down at Earth, taking pictures. Not government, but private, and they sell their pictures to anybody who wants to buy it. Another company that's already launched two successful orbital rockets is called Rocket Lab, and they built their own launch complex in New Zealand, and that's worked out quite well. You know, up until now, anyway, they did have a problem with the one launch. They scrubbed it, and they realized that they have to change a major component in their design. So they were planning this year of launching one per month, at least. And it looks like they're not going to launch until December. So that's the update on private launches. We'll follow them as they go along, as new ones come by, or if some of these drop out. This is WS2M for the SpaceNet report. The manned flights are really coming along. You have SpaceX now putting up their, they have this big arm that's going to swing out of the top of their launch complex. And that's going to be able to bring astronauts to the top of their rocket. And they're doing that now. Probably within the next couple of weeks, they'll have that completely installed. And they'll have their own white room. That's what they used to call it when astronauts got into all the different rockets, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Space Shuttle. They would go into the white room, and then they go into this big arm that swung out and connected to the top of the rocket. You climb in. Unlike what the Russians do, Russians climb up, you know, they go up an elevator all the way up, and they have a small gimp, small walkway that brings them to the rocket. This thing has maybe a 50-foot arm or longer that swings out and connects to the rocket. And after they secure it in, it pulls back, and they're ready to go. SpaceX just recently, the other day, got an approval. There's been a problem with loading fuel. They want to load the fuel, liquid oxygen, and liquid kerosene. They want to do it when the crew is already on board. There's been a lot of push to say, no, we shouldn't do that. It's not safe. Since they've already had one explosion on the launch complex back in a couple of years ago. So they've got the bugs worked out of that, and NASA has given them the approval to do that. All the other manned flights, what they would do is they would fuel the rocket, completely fueled, and then they would bring the crew out and put the crew on and launch. They're putting the crew on first, and the rocket is empty, and then they load it up with kerosene and liquid oxygen. And within 30 minutes after topping off, they launch. Somehow they got the approval on that. A lot of astronauts wrote in originally saying that would not be a good idea. I don't know. It seems to be a dangerous in the mind of some ex-astronauts going against the grain. But that's what SpaceX does. They tend to do that. On another subject, there was an EVA by the Russians. Two Russians on board the International Space Station. They have their own airlock that they could leave. We always leave out of the Quest airlock near the front of the space station. They're in the back, and they go out of something called the Piers airlock. And they did an EVA. first thing they had to do was release four satellites, and they released satellites by hand. When they do that on the U.S. border part of the space station, they put it into the small airlock in the Japanese module, and they have a robotic arm there, and they push it out to space in that fashion. Russians don't do that. They climb out of the space station doing an EVA, and they take the satellites with them, and they look in one direction, and they push it off. They just let it go. And I saw a video of that, and it worked quite well, of course. So that worked out okay. And then the main part of the EVA was to do something which I thought was interesting. This has to do with an antenna. And they had to mount this relatively large tower to the side of the functioning cargo block, the same cargo block that they would normally transmit ham radio down to the ground with. The functioning cargo block is, actually called Zarya. Zarya is the first part of the International Space Station that was ever put up there. But it went under two names. So Zarya is this, 14-foot diameter thing, 30 feet long, a little shorter than that, but it's got solar panels on it. It has a window on it. And then the one behind that is called Zesda. Zesda is the one that they live in. And that's where their bedrooms are. That's where they eat. And that's where they want to attach this exterior antenna to. They apparently thought it was going to take about 5 hours. It took over 7 hours to do this. They attached it to the Zesda from, roughly near the window that they look out. And then they had to actually hook up these antennas to it, and 40-meter antennas, correction, not 40 meters, so 70-centimeter antennas. So they needed to hook them up, transmitting, receiving type antennas. And then they had to run their coax lines, data connections, and by the time they hooked all the stuff up, they were into overtime, but they made it. And the idea of these antennas is part of the Icarus system. The Icarus system is a system developed by Russia and by Germany, part of the European Space Agency. The idea of the Icarus is to monitor on Earth the migration of animals. So Icarus is called the International Cooperation for Animal Research Using Space. So I first read about this. I said, what are they doing? And you look more into it. On Earth, they have sent people out and grabbed a hold of these birds. Most of the birds are, good-sized birds, and they're not small. And these flying foxes, whatever that is, but different types of animals. And they attach these little transceivers to their bodies, little tiny solar panels on it, and one guy had one in his hand. It looked like about an inch and a quarter long. And they attached them to all these different birds and animals, and it turns out they're little transceivers. So what Icarus is going to do, the International Cooperation for Animal Research Using Space antenna that they hooked up on the EVA, it's going to send a transmission down when it's over a certain part of the Earth. These little transceivers are going to be on low power, and then it'll pick up that signal that the ISS is transmitting. These little transmitters are going to come on, and it's going to transmit the data inside of these little boxes, what we were talking about earlier, little gyroscopes and accelerometers. And GPS, and it's going to transmit the data of where they are, where they're going, and then every pass, every time the ISS goes over the same area, these little transceivers are going to, you know, they'll go on very low power. They'll be timed. They'll know when to come on to look for the signal from the ISS. Signal comes down. They'll say, okay, the signal's here, and they'll transmit all their data up, and then they'll shut themselves down until the next pass. So I thought that was pretty incredible. There are hundreds and hundreds of animals, and they plan on shrinking these devices down even much smaller so that they could put it on even smaller animals, smaller birds. I thought that was pretty incredible. I don't know if you want the information about the power and the frequencies and everything. But my guess is, I know Dick. Dick, are you there? Would you want the information about the frequencies and that kind of information on these little transceivers that are attached to the animals? This is WS2N. Well, nothing hard. I don't hear anybody, but might as well give it out anyway then. The uplink frequencies that these things are transmitting on these little birds and flying boxes is 70 centimeters, so it's 402.25 megahertz. They have a bandwidth of 1.5 megahertz. They actually have a data rate of bits listed as 520 bits per second. They talk about the packet, and then they talk about the peak signal output. It's only 50 milliwatts, and that will be going up to the International Space Station. I thought that was incredible. How these antennas that these Russians installed on the EVA are going to be able to pick up thousands of different signals at one time. Separate them out. You know, they have packets, so they'll know which one is from what animal, and so forth. So the downlink frequency is again it's UHF 468.1 megahertz. So it's not within the amateur band, and they have a 50 hertz bandwidth on the transmitting signal back down to the animal. And a little high a bit, right? And that's the story on Icarus. So I thought that was pretty good. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it. I think one other topic I had. But any questions or comments for this portion of the net? This is WS2N. I guess not. The only update I had was on the Hayabusa Japanese mission to asteroid called Ryugu. Ryugu is in the asteroid belt, and took this spacecraft, I think, 3.5 years or so to get out to this location. Now this thing is about a quarter of a mile away from the asteroid. They sent pictures back, and the goal of Hayabusa 2 is to go in very, very close to the point where it's almost touching it, and then they have these little landing devices that are going to separate from the mother craft and land on the asteroid over time. There's about four different ones, different landing type of things. They have system where they're going to get some grams. If they can get like 2 grams, they'd be happy, but they might get more than that, and eventually bring it back to Earth in 2020. And they have plans on deorbiting and eventually landing in Australia, out in the middle of nowhere, Australia. So following this mission along, took off in 2014. It's out there now. It's going to be in the vicinity of this asteroid for probably a year and a half or so. It's going to take m-
million pictures. And it's got lasers on board, so it's got to know the depth of every little centimeter of this asteroid. Asteroids, I think, about a half mile in, you know, wide, so. And gravitation-wise, they had a report of 1/60,000th of the amount of gravity. Accidentally just lift it up 1 foot too quick, it'd float off into space.
Can I make a call, please? This is Kilowatt 6 Delta Papa Zulu.
Not at this time. I'm just wondering if there's anybody that has any comments or questions for this portion of the TechNet. This is WS2N. Dick, I wonder if you have anything further, or if not, maybe we could go over to Roy. Nothing heard. Roy, do you have any other topics or anything? Because if not, I've come to a grinding halt. AC2GS, WS2N.
I always have topics. Can you hear me?
Can I fry my antenna?
Yeah, I copy. I copy you, Roy.
Okay, if you want, I'll do the piece that I told people I would do next week about the poor kid who got 1/6 of his brain removed.
Very good. last week I went through a lot of topics that were backed up because I had plenty of time because of the radio problems. But yeah, back to you, Roy. WS2N.
WS2N, this is K6DPZ. Could I make a call, please?
Negative. Over to you, Roy.
Talking about nerve cells, a new case study from Pittsburgh highlights the resilience of the human brain. It details a boy who, despite losing 1/3 of the right hemisphere of his brain when he was 6, is now mostly an ordinary 10-year-old. Though he can't see past the left side of his face, his brain has compensated for the loss in some ways by forming new neural connections, allowing him to recognize faces and objects as easily as anyone else. The boy, referred to as UD, in a paper published a few weeks ago in Cell Reports, started having severe seizures at the age of 4. The seizures were caused by a slow-growing brain tumor found in the occipital and temporal lobes of his right hemisphere. Eventually, after drugs and other treatment did little to alleviate his symptoms, the boy's family opted for a radical option. Just before turning 7, the boy had his entire occipital and much of his temporal lobe removed, accounting for 1/3 of his right hemisphere. Let me drop.
WS2N, K6DPZ, why can't I make a call, sir?
The drastic surgery was a success. The boy's seizures went away, as did the tumor, but there was no telling how he would progress after losing these crucial parts of his brain. The occipital lobe acts as a command center for the visual information we take in from our eyes, letting us perceive vision and helping us decide what those shapes and colors mean to us. The temporal lobe, among other things, also takes in the processes, visual and auditory information from the outside world. Let me drop. The brain is already known to sometimes reorganize itself when damaged, forming new connections between neurons in other areas to compensate for the ones that were lost. But research into the brain's plasticity, as it's called, has mostly been limited to how it affects our memory or learning abilities. UD brain wasn't able to replace the low-level functions of the right hemisphere's visual processing, meaning he can't visually perceive the left-hand side of his world. but his brain's left hemisphere did take over higher orders of function typically found in the right hemisphere. His visual behavior is excellent, absolutely normal, a researcher said. Even though he only has one visual system, he's been reconfiguring it to do the work of both hemispheres. Much like everyone else does, with their blind spot, UD compensates for his left-sided blindness by moving his eyes or head around with little awareness of what he's missing, and the impairment hasn't impacted his growth and development. He has no signs of cognitive or other health problems. Let me drop. There are still lots of questions about the limits of brain plasticity and vision. The brains of children older than UD might not be able to reorganize as effectively as he did, while younger children might do even better, letting them see more of the world. Other factors, like a child's cognitive functions before surgery or the exact cause of their seizures, might also play a role in their prognosis. The type of surgery UD underwent to treat his epilepsy, while radical, is often successful, eliminating seizures in 60 to 70% of the time. But it's rarely carried out. It's usually left as a last resort. Let me drop for any questions or comments. Okay, I'll hit you with another one then. Let's see. I would take this next item with more than a grain of permafrost. From the same country that brought you Polywater, as well as that wacky genetic theory, Lysenkoism, I bring you news that a team of Russian scientists published their exciting discovery in this month's issue of the journal Doklady Biological Sciences, where they announced that they had apparently discovered ancient nematode worms that they were able to resurrect themselves after spending at least 32,000 years buried in permafrost. The discovery, if legitimate, would represent the longest surviving return from the cold ever seen in a complex multi-celled organism, dwarfing even the famous tardigrade, or better known as the microscopic water bears. Let me drop. The worms were found among more than 300 samples of frozen soil pulled from the Kyoma River lowlands in northeastern Siberia by researchers. Two of the samples held the worms, with one from a buried squirrel burrow dating back 32,000 years and one from a glacier dating back 40,000 years. After isolating intact nematodes, the scientists kept the samples at 68 degrees Fahrenheit and left them surrounded by food in a petri dish just to see what would happen. Over the next few weeks, they gradually spotted flickers of life as worms ate their food and even cloned new family members. These cloned worms were then cultured separately, and they too thrived. It's apparently not out of the question that these worms could have been revived after so long, according to a nematologist not involved in this report. Let me drop. When asked to comment about this, nematologist not involved in this paper opined that theoretically it is possible that if the organisms were protected from physical damage that they could that would compromise their structural integrity during their frozen internment, they should be able to revive upon thawing rehydration for a very long period of time, but at the same time, the team's finding could still be a dud. The biggest issue is the potential for contamination of ancient samples with contemporary organisms. While the researchers do admit that the possibility of contamination in the paper, they say it's unlikely. They cited strict procedures to ensure complete sterility, and given that the ice samples were buried 100 feet and 15 feet down respectively, they argue it's implausible that modern-day nematodes could have wormed their way down that deep. Still, all this kind of reminds me of that story of the Russian polywater that I presented a few months ago. The discovery of such long-lived creatures would be an astounding record-breaker. Let me drop. Ancient bacteria buried in salt crystals over 250 million years ago supposedly have been brought back to life, but the oldest thawed-out animals only date back decades at most, such as a group of tardigrades, otherwise known as water bear, that were resurrected after only 30 years in ice. The more complex nature of these allegedly ancient nematodes could reveal more insights about the feasibility of cryostasis or how to survive in extreme conditions like space. the researchers speculated. And at the very least, they might provide clues as to how these worms have evolved over time. Over 40,000 years, we should expect to detect significant differences in evolutionary divergence between ancient and contemporary populations, a nematologist not involved in the paper suggested. Because we know so little about the genetics of these modern-day cold-loving worms, even a genetic comparison that finds substantial differences between the thawed-out worms and our present-day population wouldn't necessarily confirm their longevity. It may take very sophisticated tests akin to those that confirm the existence of nematode species that can survive deep inside the crust of Earth to know whether these worms are actually ancient. This is AC2GS. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
Where were these things found?
Good old Siberia. Well, there might be a follow-up. It might be kind of clouded. It's not getting the press that the polywater got, and that took years to disprove. So my money's on that it's a lab contamination, personally, but we'll see what happens. I can do another one if you're up for it, Paul. Okay, with it. Let's see. What do I got up here? Let's see. If you asked anyone out there on this net to name the world's fastest creature, it's likely that we all would respond with something like a peregrine falcon, a cheetah, or a marlin. But researchers from Georgia Institute of Technology would suggest that we should look at smaller life forms, like something called the Spirosmosum ambiguum, a worm-like creature that reaches breakneck speeds through rapid shrinkage. Spirostium ambiguum is a single-celled protozoan that's often found in lakes and ponds, and it typically moves around by using tiny cells called cilia. But when S. ambiguum is startled, the normally 4-millimeter-long protozoan contracts its worm-like body with lightning speed, reducing the length of its body by more than 60%. It performs this rapid rate of shrinkage in just a fraction of a second. Its transformation into a football-like object looks practically instantaneous to the human eye. Researchers at Georgia Tech's School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering would very much like to solve this mystery, and a 4-year research grant recently received from the National Science Foundation will surely help. It may sound quite esoteric to study the impossibly quick movements of such a tiny creature, but insights in this area could lead to advanced robotics, nanotechnology, and other subjects. Nature has clearly found a way. Scientists just have to figure out the details. Let me drop.
Can I make a call, please?
As engineers, we like to look at how nature has handled important challenges, one of the researchers said in a statement. We are always thinking about how to make these tiny things that we see zipping around in nature. If we can understand how they work, maybe the information can cross over to fill the gap for small robots that can move fast with very little energy use. Larger vertebrates, whether they be cheetahs, birds, or humans, depend on proteins called actin and myosin to move. The same cannot be said of protozoans, who move by using tiny molecular springs, latches, and biological motors. What's more, these mechanisms rely on the physics of the very small and could not possibly translate to larger animals. If they had only actin and myosin proteins that make up our muscles, they couldn't generate enough force to actually move that fast, the researchers added. The smaller they are, the faster they go, up to 200 meters per second squared. That's really off the charts. Let me drop.
Can I make a call, please? Manil.
Keep in mind that an acceleration of 450 miles per hour per second is about 80% of the acceleration of a frog's tongue as it catches its prey, or about 73% of the acceleration of an AIM-9E missile. Success in this area would result in the development of molecular machinery, microbots, and that are capable of similar accelerations, and importantly, are able to survive the blazing fast motion. As we all know, the cheetah is the world's fastest land animal, but if you want to be an annoying know-it-all at your next cocktail party, just tell your guests that the world's fastest land animal relative to its size is something called Parasotomus macropalpus, a mite native to Southern California. This creature can travel 322 body lengths per second, which for a human being would be like running 1,300 miles an hour. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
K6DPZ, my comment is I'd like to make a call. I don't know why you don't let me make a call. Give me a reason, and I'll logically listen to it. I have a PhD in engineering. I'm no fool.
So, Dick, K2RIW, are you out there?
Dickie, are you out there?
Money with the known, less money with the unknown. I guess that's how it's played. KG2RY.
KG2RY. Let me see if I can hear a sticky dicky. K2RIW. Kilowatt 6, Dirty Purple Zombies, the Pirate Jammer. Are you out there, Dick? Dick, are you afraid to talk to me? Come on, be nice. What's the reverend is going to slap you on your hand?
Paul, are you out there?
Yeah, I'm getting some kind of, I think it's a band opening. But I'll good enough. We'll see you later. And very well done, Roy. AC2GS,
WS2N. WS2N, this is K6DPC. You are a very knowledgeable man. I do listen to your space report. You know your stuff. I'm impressed. But please, I know my stuff too. I have a PhD in engineering. I design communications equipment. I'm recognized right up to Washington. So please, give me at least the courtesy of making a call to the goose.
So, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy, and I want to thank everyone for listening and participating and asking questions and such. And once again, I will remind everyone before the repeater times out and goes to sleep for tonight that the email address, if you have any questions, comments, statements, topics you want covered, topics you don't want covered, just send them to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Or you can find links to all these articles that I've been talking about at roy.ac2gs.com. So I think we're going to roll this up and wrap it up. So thank you all to everyone. Have a good week, and hopefully we'll all be back to do this again next Sunday night.
New York Fire Department, Inspector Division, Inspector of PR, is going to be going up to the site. There's not enough fire protection equipment on the equipment for Limark, and they'll have 24 hours to either put the proper equipment up, but also Limark repeaters will be taken off of North Shore Tower. You people played with the wrong people, let me tell you. K6DPC, clear. Deputy Chief of Communications, NYFD. You don't screw with the duck. Man, be a little weasel, did you get that? You better prepare to move all the stuff out of North Shore Towers. Because North Shore's management is going to get a fine within 24 hours of $4,500 for improper fire protection equipment to your stuff you have up there, you little weasel. K6DPC clear.
K2
KRIW is the dickhead.
K2RIW, Dick, are you still in there? KRIW, K6DPZ. Listen, Dick, I know you're a very smart guy. RFID work you do. The duck, K6DPZ, holds 5 United States patents on intended design under my name, Dick, not under some company, okay? So don't come against me, technically. I will eat you up, chew you out, and piss you out. I thought you were a friend. You sold me under the bus, my friend. K6DPZ.
When did this become a
Levinitas? Hey, listen, jerk, give me a call letter. I'll talk to you. You don't have no call. I'm not going to talk to a non-licensed station. Who are you? What's your call? You have enough balls to give me your call? This is not 11 meters. It's 2 meters. And, you know, you come on, give a call or shut your face. I've been a ham for 60. I've never got a pink ticket. Laura, the enforcement officer, I know, is still. The town, you know, the repeater, K2, you know, the president tried to screw me over. He made a big mistake. Talk to me or you don't. I regard you very respectfully. You're very. Is trying to jam me out. You're not doing it. I'm running enough power. I saturate the limiter of the repeater. I design repeaters. I design communication systems. Listen, you little pisshead. It's my power.
Okay, 2 hours.